This is Liner Note Leftovers, your weekly musical discovery hosted by 106.1 The GOAT's resident crate digger, Dan Soul. Let's dive in.
Good day, good evening, good morning, good noon, good whatever time and space you're listening to this edition of Liner Note Leftovers on. We are back once again after the Halloween episode. This is episode 31, Dark Horses. Now, before we get into anything else, I owe you an apology because we didn't do an episode last week. I didn't even warn you that we weren't doing an episode last week. And that is because of something that was sort of out of my hands. We had a pretty catastrophic technical failure with the way that we upload podcasts. So basically, not only could I not get in to put in a podcast, I couldn't even get on here to warn you that I couldn't upload a podcast. It's very awkward, but obviously the situation is sorted out now. So please know that I was thinking about you and thinking about this podcast while we were down, but we're back up again, and we got five more rock and roll stories to tell you. We got the story of the Dark Horse Tour, George Harrison's most disastrous tour, and you wouldn't think that'd be a sentence that would have those words together, but hey, it is. We're talking about Dark Horses in Queen's biggest album and Rage Against the Machine's first album, and we're going to talk about a band that's been described as the poor man's Rush, but deserves so much better. Oh, and by the way, just a heads up, because there is Rage Against the Machine in this one, language warning. If you're easily offended, I don't know how you'd call yourself a rock fan, but you know, just a heads up if you're worried. Now, let's get into today's Liner Note Leftovers. Let's drop that needle and let's go! You know, you'd be hard-pressed to believe that a Beatle going on tour would be a disaster. I mean, Paul McCartney still packs houses to this day, ditto Ringo Starr, but hey, 1974 may have been a different time, because on November 2nd of that year, George Harrison started the Dark Horse Tour, which was maligned at the time as one of the worst tours of all time. Now, hear me out on this, this is how it happened. So in 74, George Harrison was the first member of the Beatles post-split to go on tour, and in fact, the Beatles hadn't gone on tour since 1966, 4 years before they broke up. And that was for a lot of reasons. They were mobbed by crazed and violent fans. They almost got arrested in the Philippines. A psychic predicted their plane would crash. Being on the road just sucks. Locked in a car, train, plane, hotel room, go, 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 go. So George Harrison knows that touring already does his head in, but he wants to show off this new experimental music he's doing. He wants to have a showcase tour for Ravi Shankar, who joined him the whole way. But despite the ambition, the mind was willing, but the body was not ready. Which was probably exacerbated by the fact that all the way up until the first day of the Dark Horse Tour, George Harrison was recording in studio. So he's already exhausted from that, and he's ramping up the show every single night. A Beatles show would be 25, 30 minutes. Go on, bang out the hits, leave once again. Now George Harrison's playing for 2.5 hours for 47 gigs, right after doing a whole bunch of recording in studio. So on the first show of the tour in Vancouver, his voice is already fried to the point where he's got laryngitis. To try and keep up, he's drinking a mixture of honey, vinegar, warm water, and a little bit or maybe a bit more of cocaine. You know, the Wild West approach to medicine. And of course, that does not help in the slightest. Fans and critics would trash George Harrison for his weird and eclectic takes on famous Beatles tunes. They would get frustrated about long sets of Indian music. Bill Graham was constantly fighting to kick Ravi Shankar off tour. It got to the point where people were saying, George, get ready, because when you get home to England, you're finished. You're done as a musician. So finally, when this disaster of a grueling tour is over, George Harrison went home to his garden and rejuvenate himself. And that rejuvenation took about, give or take, 26 years? Because he refused to go on tour again until Eric Clapton, of all people, convinced him to hit the road once again in 1991 for a short Japan tour. And despite this being an absolute trash in the papers, bootlegs of the concerts have a kind of a cult following to this day. Some people have actually flipped their opinion and praised the tour, and it's actually been recognized by some people as a forerunner to what would become world music. But one thing's true about it, if you go out and find it, he certainly wasn't playing to people's nostalgia about the Beatles. But you know, considering the solo work of the four guys, maybe that's a good thing. With his voice a little bit less dark horse, this is George Harrison. What is life?
Tell me, what is my life?
News of the World. While it is heralded as one of the classics of rock and roll, it is, for all intents and purposes, the most stripped down Queen record there is. Well, it's as stripped down as Queen could be. But here is why. Because in the summer of 1977, Queen is going through the first of a couple of midlife crises, largely brought on by a slump in sales between a night at the opera and a day at the races. A lot of people were pondering on whether or not Queen was still viable in the late 1970s. I mean, stadium rock was starting to become passé in favor of punk and new wave, and this clash was already physically evident. When Queen began recording News of the World, the Sex Pistols were actually in the next studio over finishing Nevermind the Bollocks, leading to one unfortunate night when Sex Pistols bassist Sid Vicious busted in to Queen's control room, went over the mic and sneered, "Freddie Mercury, have you succeeded in bringing ballet to the masses then?" To which Mercury responds, "Oh yes, Simon Ferocious, we're trying our best, dear." This encounter, combined with what was going on in the music scene, led Queen to want to strip it down a little bit more, leading some people to even believe songs like Sheer Heart Attack and Fight From the Inside were direct salutes or responses to the burgeoning punk movement, though these songs have been written since as early as 1974. But songs like We Will Rock You, which is largely hand claps and foot stomps as opposed to loud operatic sections, still had an element of rhythm and timekeeping and musical technicality that a lot of punk bands didn't have, especially in the early days of the movement, even if they are established as quick and easy jock jams, which we've talked about before. But don't get it twisted like it was stripped down entirely. Even though songs like Sleeping on the Sidewalk were recorded in a single take, other songs like We Will Rock You used physics to create the massive stomping and clapping sounds. We Are the Champions wouldn't feel right to Brian May unless there was a big bombastic guitar solo on it. And hey, Brian May was even bringing musical prowess with double hand tapping on It's Late months before Van Halen was thought to pioneer it on Halen 1. Though Brian May does say he stole that from Billy Gibbons. No, actually, he stole that from a guy who says he stole that from Billy Gibbons. But either way, put this album together, put that striking News of the World robot holding Queen dead in its hand cover on the front, and you got yourself a album full of an infectious, rocking earworm grooves that certainly show that Queen was still around in 1977. Today's legacy of rock track from News of the World. Can't go wrong with a stripped down rocker like this one. So We Will Rock You, We Are the Champions.
Buddy, you're a boy, make a big noise, playing in the street, gonna be a big man someday. You got mud on your face, you big disgrace, kicking your can all over the place, singing, We will rock you. 29 years
you've been raging against the machine. Yeah, that's how long it's been since November 3rd, 1992, when Rage Against the Machine's self-titled debut dropped. Meant to not only be the antithesis of everything in music, but the antithesis of society as a whole. Which is kind of ironic, because the same day this album dropped, Bill Clinton was elected president. But the unlikely story of Rage Against the Machine's debut album begins even earlier than that, when the Harvard-educated son of political activists named Tom Morello meets the street-educated political activist's son, Zach De La Rocha, and the two start jamming together, taking influence from a plethora of different sources, not only in terms of their politically and socially charged lyrics, but also their music in general. Rage Against the Machine took some love from everything from Led Zeppelin to Public Enemy to The Clash, and they amalgamated this all into a jambalaya pot of mixing punk and metal and hip-hop. Basically, on paper, this did not seem like a good idea, especially when you consider the music scene was kind of awash in a level of spandex and stupidity, I think is the best way to describe it. So Rage Against the Machine sets out with the goal of being a musical Molotov cocktail for not just the music scene, but for the whole society in general. I mean, with an album cover that features the Thich Nhat Hanh Buddhist monk self-immolation protest picture, you knew you were getting something crazy. And Rage went into this thing fully not expecting anybody to hear the record. Lot of factors. The supercharged music. The fact that they were an interracial band. The fact that it was going to be an uncompromised expression of worldviews as musicians and activists. The guys were just trying to be real. But strangely enough, it was a screw-up that broke Rage Against the Machine. So despite their best efforts to not become a part of the corporate music culture, people still are getting their hands on this album in droves. So much so that it starts going into the top 40 in England, meaning it's gonna be on the Radio 1 countdown with DJ Bruno Brooks, who accidentally screws up and plays the uncensored version of Killing in the Name Of, which wasn't actually even listed on the album tracks because the record label wouldn't put it, you know, the whole one line that you know I'm talking about right now. He plays it accidentally in its entirety, and this is like a Sex Pistols moment. People turn up the radio, what the hell is this? So much so that before they were even big in America, when they came back to the UK, kids were sleeping in the lobbies to see Rage Against the Machine. Much like grunge that had come a year earlier, this was a powder keg for angry, rebellious young people who wanted someone to say what they were thinking. And despite the censorship and keeping them kicked out of music television rotation, Rage started picking up fans in Europe, in South America, in Asia. So when they go back to the US, they were playing clubs, opening for like House of Pain, but they were headlining festivals in the rest of the world, to the point where, and don't let anybody tell you that this is activism, the record company said, "We'll make your next single the 6.5 minute song Freedom, and a video in support of Leonard Peltier, who's an indigenous activist unfairly convicted in the killing of FBI agents." The record label suggested that, not Rage Against the Machine. But either way, their mantra of no samples, no keyboards, no synthesizers, and always real went off like a bomb track. I think that's the perfect way to say it. And continues to have Rage Against the Machine be the anthem for the people that need it to this day. Now just kick back for a second here and imagine if you heard this coming through your radio a couple of decades ago. You know, amongst some of the uninitiated in the rock and roll world, it's been said that Canadian trio Triumph are the poor man's Rush. And while there are similarities, both are a trio, both hail from the Greater Toronto Area, and both have some serious prog rock chop, that's about where the similarities end. Because while Rush was already trailblazing the scene in 77, Triumph was still trying to find their voice. But oh boy, did they do it on November 4th, 1977, when they released Rock and Roll Machine. Now at the time, they were an on-the-road working band with one studio album under their belt, a self-titled debut that had been released by a small Canadian record label. But if that album was them finding their footing, Rock and Roll Machine was them finding their voice. Because not only were they trying to make a stadium rock epic on the level of a Led Zeppelin or a Grand Funk or a Ted Nugent, there was also some reggae influences like Bob Marley, there was blues and R&B influences, there was some Eagles influences. During the recording of Rock and Roll Machine, the boys in Triumph, Rick Emmett, Gilmore, and Michael Levine are throwing everything in the pot to make this album work. They're looking to make an eclectic and even sometimes prog rocky Rush sound while also carving out more of a mainstream rock and roll blue collar direction that was more Triumph speed. Now the sound is down, the sound is solid, the sound works, but this is where it gets even harder for Triumph. It was not an easy road for the guys. They get signed to RCA Records, who agrees to put the album out, but they want to chop and screw a bunch of things. One of the mistakes, despite having ties in America, they didn't release the album right away, only opting to release it when they could put some tracks from the self-titled Triumph album on there, confusing some diehard Canadian fans who bought the Canadian version, and then finding out there was another version that had different tracks on it from an album they already owned. It was messy, man, I tell you, and it almost got even messier when RCA suggested leaving off the cover of Joe Walsh's Rocky Mount Way from Triumph's Rock and Roll Machine, which that would have been very stupid because that was Triumph's biggest hit, the one that opened the door for them internationally. Now it gets even messier from there, dear friends. They were signed to different labels in different countries. Nobody was willing to commit any money to help them survive, thrive, or even tour. But interestingly, through radio play and almost word of mouth, Triumph begins to become triumphant. They get recognition worldwide. And in fact, it might not seem that way now to the uneducated uninitiated who weren't around at the time, myself included in researching this, but Triumph was one of the biggest bands in the world at a certain time. Even if sometimes when they landed at airports, kids would come up for autographs and say, "Hey, Geddy Lee, I really liked your last album." It was a little awkward, so to speak. But despite some ups and downs along the road, you know, great record sales, arena tours, but also pyro blowing up, getting flooded with dirty toilet water at one club they were playing, and a breakup that would last several years, Triumph triumphed on and became one of the shining stars of Canadian music that we're still talking about, we're still spinning today. So all awkwardness aside, I'd say they did all right for themselves, and it all started with this tune right here, a cover of Joe Walsh's Rocky Mountain Way. If I told you to think of a song that was Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, you would probably tell me Woodstock, probably that or Ohio. And it makes sense that they'd have a song about Woodstock. They were there, they felt the vibe. In fact, it was only the second gig Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young had played together. But this song, Woodstock, which has been praised as one of the most in-depth, truthful and vibe-capturing songs about Woodstock, was written by somebody who wasn't even there, and that was Joni Mitchell, who was the first one to lay it down before Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young started recording it on November 5th, 1969. But in the why and the how is where the story starts getting interesting. So originally in 1969, Joni Mitchell didn't already have her adversity to playing music festivals. That would come later, especially after the disastrous Isle of Wight performance. It wasn't her idea to miss Woodstock, she was scheduled. But her manager, David Geffen, insisted that she had to appear on the Dick Cavett show instead. Which, don't get me wrong, he was a cool guy, but at the same time, Woodstock was Woodstock. So she doesn't go and instead is stuck in David Geffen's hotel room to watch Woodstock on television. There was almost the possibility that she could have hitched a ride with James Taylor, of all people, but rumor is he had just gotten into a bad motorcycle accident which broke both of his arms, and that was it for her trip. Either way, she was watching it in the hotel on TV. And despite that, despite watching it on a little black and white, maybe a color screen, that was enough. She says watching this was a full-on God mode experience, something that she regarded as a modern miracle, which flourishes in the lyrics she would write down about this event. Namely, when she compares Woodstock's festival site at Yasker's Farm to the Garden of Eden. And then, of course, there is the first line, "I came across a child of God who was walking on the road." But despite not being there, this is crazy, she was not there. She was able to perfectly meld that feeling of peaceful intent with the feeling of the almost assured destruction of the late 1960s. So sometimes after she lays down this track, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young get back to where she is, because Graham Nash was actually her boyfriend at the time. She teaches them the track, and instantly he knows, this is the greatest account of this concert that I've ever heard. And we were there. Nobody did it better. So they instantly get permission to cover the thing and take it to the record plant in New York. Someone else was actually recording there at the time too, Jimi Hendrix, who Stephen Stills burst into one of his sessions and gave him this recently composed song and suggested that he, Jimi Hendrix, and Buddy Miles cover it. That version was released on Both Sides of the Sky only in 2018. They opted not to release that one and instead got back in as Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young in November, found that they were making magic, and released it unto the world. Now I'm gonna play that tune, a tune that transports you back to 1969 and back to Woodstock, and just imagine what it must have been like to write this, as Joni Mitchell said, from the experience of the deprived kid who didn't get to go. Puts a new spin on it a little bit here. And with that, that's it. That's all. That's another Liner Note Leftovers in the books. As always, it was a blast bringing some music stories to you, digging into the liner notes, and just nerding out overall. I hope you had some fun, learned something too, and maybe knew a little bit more than you do before. Now, before we get out of here for this one, I will let y'all know we are still in talks about the future of the podcast. I got a few people I'm working with to help me figure out, hey, should we keep doing this? What's it going to look like in the future? How can we make this better? That kind of thing. But at the end of the day, I do answer to you, the person who listens to this the most. So if you have any feedback about this podcast, you can always email me, dsoul@vistaradio.ca, or hit up my day job, 106.1 The Goat. I would love to hear from you about it. Or if you just want to chat music or shoot the breeze, it's always good to make a connection, especially when we're talking about the future of this podcast. All there is to say now, have fun, be safe out there, and don't forget, always grab life and your vinyl by the edges.
That's a wrap on this week's episode. For more musical discoveries with Dan Soul, head to mylloydminsternow.com or subscribe to Liner Note Leftovers wherever you get your podcast fix.